Grace Kitto, author of Saving Grace, which the tagline is a memoir, a lick of self-sabotage, a dash of self-knowledge, and a load of weight lost. I have to say, I did really, really enjoy reading it and really resonated really resonated with me.
Oh, that's fantastic. I'd love to hear that. That's really good.
Yeah.
I'm so sure that it has an audience. I'm not sure how easy it is for people to find it because it's not a classic diet book. In fact, it's a sort of hidden anti-diet book. Even though I go on diets all the way through it, it's all about how it's not about the diet. That's kind of the message, isn't it?
Yes, and it's your personal journey, which is, yes, physically dieting, but more psychologically figuring out how you work with food.
Sure. Saving Grace is a book it's not a diet book. It's about how losing weight is not principally about going on diets. I spent 45 years on diets and all I did was gain weight. And I couldn't work out why. And I actually felt a little bit mad because I couldn't work out why. Because it didn't seem like the more decisive I was, the more I wagged my finger at myself to tell myself that I should really do it this time, I couldn't. So writing Saving Grace was a way of me addressing the problem in a whole different way.
It's because you got to a point after sort of a lifetime of habitually overeating, not to a great extent, but a consistent extent, and to the point where you were obese and it was causing, a rift in your marriage because your husband was extremely concerned about your health and risk of diabetes. And he was angry at you, and you were angry at him for being angry at you.
Sure. Yeah. And his father died of diabetes, or the effects of diabetes, and my mother did. So he was understandably impatient. He had got the message and it had made him vigilant about his own weight and his own health. And he couldn't understand why it didn't have the same effect on me. And it just made them increasingly frustrated. I think now, actually looking back, to be honest, I think he's a bit ashamed of some of the ways he talked to me about it. But, when I look back, I think, was that like an intervention on an alcoholic? Did he keep me mindful of the problem? Was he part of the solution or was he part of the problem? I don't think I know the answer to that. I love him, I'm still with him, so I guess on the whole I think his intervention was constructive. Some of it felt painful. I think we've both learned a lot through the process that I've been through.
Yeah, I think regardless of the words that he sometimes used, anyone seeing someone they love, putting themselves in danger, it's frustrating to see. And it came from that place, which was clear.
Sure.
But it also came, you had to have your own come to Jesus moment, and you described that as the cat over bridge moment.
Yeah.
Tell us what happened.
Well, although I start the book with it, to be fair, I should make clear that what happened at Canterbury Bridge took me 2 years to internalise before I could act on it. But I trace it all back to Canterbury Bridge. It was a very crucial moment of understanding. I left my job. I am still a television producer, and I left my work that day. I'd been so busy, I hadn't had a chance to think. I'd been rushing around. And as I walked through the car park to get to my car, I had a chance to think about myself again and do a bit of sort of self-care. And I realised how massively frustrated I felt to be so overweight. And it seemed like I could do all these effective things during the day. And then when it came to me, I just couldn't apply it. And it really annoyed me. And I thought, okay, this time I'm going to do it. I'm really going to do it. I'm going to do it. Got in the car, drove home. Within 5 or 10 minutes, I passed this beauty spot in the middle of Dartmoor. I pass every day in both directions. And in it, there's this huge car park, sometimes heaving when it's sunny, But sometimes, as on this day, completely empty, and yet there's an ice cream van sitting there. Who knows how it makes a living, but nevertheless, there it is. Without stopping to think, I pulled into the car park, I parked, I bought an ice cream, I sat in the car eating it, it had two flakes in it, chocolate. I don't like chocolate particularly, and I'm not actually very keen on ice cream. I sat there eating it, and then thought, oh my God, what am I doing? I am actually deranged. I 5 minutes ago made a clear decision, and I meant it, to go on a diet, and here I am eating something that's calorie laden, and it's not even something I like that much. Something is really awry here. Something is wrong with my brain. And that was the clincher moment to think, I've been attacking this from the wrong way. Of course I know what the calories in an ice cream are, or a flake-ish, you know, I can work that out. But that's not doing it for me. Knowing that doesn't help me not eat it. How on earth did I drive into this car park and do this thing? It set off a train of thought that, you know, took me a long time to really understand, but it was very, very crucial.
And what was that train of thought? How did you come to the conclusion that it wasn't the calorie counting, and it wasn't even really a matter of willpower, that it was a different part of you that you had to address?
What I realized was, this is so strange how we learn things as we get older, isn't it? I, years ago, read Freud, and I'd read about the theory of the unconscious. I thought, oh yeah, yeah, that makes sense. Never really thought about it properly, never really felt it. And suddenly that's what came to me. I thought, there's got to be some other driver here. There's some other driver in my head that is telling me that to stop and eat an ice cream is a good idea. Even though the bit that talks to me all the time, the articulated bit of my thinking, says, no, 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 we're not doing that, we're going to do something else. And then the more I thought about it, the more I thought, it's like school prefect in your head thing. Okay, right, now, rally the troops, what are we going to do? We're going to do this, and then we'll do that, and we'll do so. But you know what? The number of times that I just haven't done it, I voted in the other direction. My inner prefect says, tidy your bedroom. I don't do it. Why did I do it? Didn't I mean it? Of course I meant it. So how is it that I didn't do it? How is it that that didn't materialize in terms of action?
And yeah, I sort of, when I was reading that and trying to understand it and place it for me, I sort of, in the way that, you know, there's the guy that's really bad for you, and yet, you know,
yeah,
it's like your hormones, it's like you're following your ovaries around. You're like, I'm not going to call, I'm not going to text. And then your ovaries are like, yes, you are. Guess what? You already did, you know? And there you are on the booty call, you know, you said yes again. And it's that same. And also, all of that same and self-judgment heaped on it as well.
Yeah, yeah. Well, of course, that's the other thing. Quite apart from the physical dangers of being overweight, the constant emotional turmoil of trying to do something that you're failing at, feeling ashamed and degraded because you don't, then forgetting about it, oh, I'm going to live my life, who cares about this, I don't care about this issue, cracking on, and then off you go again. No, no, actually I'm going to get my life in order, I'm going to give up the guy, I'm going to give up smoking, I'm going to go on a diet, whatever it might be, and then you don't, and then off you go again. Oh my God, I failed again. Ashamed, irritated with yourself. It's just a spiral of failure in a sense, although of course the rest of our lives carry on and we have all our other successes and nice things and lovely relationships, and so you don't have to think about it all the time. But this little thread of the thing that you try to do that you're not doing continues to haunt you, or it did for me anyway, and I do think that's true for other people who have various kinds of addictive issue. It sort of undermines your ability to make decisions about yourself. Well, that's how it feels, and so it doesn't go away.
Well, and also, it's almost as if when you're overweight, you're public property as well. So
yeah,
that you're open
true.
To, you know, you're open to comment, ridicule,
yeah,
and even shame.
Absolutely.
So not only are you heaping it on yourself, but somehow it's deemed okay to point and laugh.
And of course, that's true when you start to lose weight. That's also public property, and people
yes.
feel that they can talk about it. They feel they can tell you that you've lost too much. They can tell you how you did it. They can tell you, if you're foolish enough to say, oh, yes, I've stalled, they say, oh, you probably ate more this week. You think, no, actually, I didn't. You know, I'm really on this now. I know what I'm doing. They say, oh, well, you probably did less exercise. No, you're actually not listening to me. I'm doing the same things, and I've spent 6 weeks, and I haven't lost weight, and it's frustrating. But they simply don't believe you. They know best, even though they actually haven't been on diet and done the same things. That's maddening. That's one of the other things I wanted to, because actually dieting is much harder than most diet books let on to you, because I have now been everybody's personal guinea pig, because I've tracked it. And I do know that it's possible to eat, say, 11 or 1200 calories a day, or even 1000 calories a day, and do exercise, and not lose weight for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks. And then suddenly it all starts moving again. You have to keep with it. But I wanted people to understand that all those diets that tell you that it's perfectly possible for you to lose a pound a week, it's that's not necessarily true. It's not quite like that. It's and if you don't, it doesn't mean to say you failed, and it doesn't mean to say it stopped. It just means you have to, you know, bear with it. Carry on.
Okay, so
you get there in the end.
So you did decide to take this seriously.
Uh-huh.
And it took you a while to figure out what the drivers were. And
yeah.
So you combined, there's science, and then there's Bridget. Tell us about Bridget.
Well, she was one of the really key stages of change. I'll just take you back 1 second, because I think there were three things. I felt there were three things that made a huge difference in the way that I approached weight loss this time. One of them was committing to a year to say, I don't care how much I lose, but I'm going to be serious about this for a year. Never done that before in my life. Of course, actually, that was life-changing, because I never stopped then of not being on a diet. But, you know, that vigilance I learned, I then learned to apply long term, so that was great. And then the next thing was to understand that the choice of diet wasn't that important, that actually for all the diets that are so successful, the choice of which one you go for doesn't really matter, because they kind of all work, pretty much all of them work. And exactly which one to choose was a relatively minor decision was important, because it meant that I didn't attach all my thoughts and feelings to the diet. The regime of the diet wasn't the most important thing. What was important was the internal journey, and that's where Bridget came in. Because by that time, I had really accepted that there were a lot of unconscious drivers in this. I thought, how on earth do you approach your unconscious? Your unconscious does not articulate itself. And as you can probably imagine, my conscious thought articulates itself a lot. It doesn't half rabbit on it goes, blah blah blah, not leaving much room for the other stuff that's going on. Now Freud would tell you that's the larger proportion of your thinking is the unconscious part, which is quite a scary thought, because you don't have access to it and it doesn't articulate itself in words. He said, look at what you do, and that's what your unconscious is up to. That's an interesting idea, isn't it? You know, you vote with your feet, in effect, in terms of the way you treat people, in terms of your actions, in terms of all sorts of things. So I had to think about how you would recalibrate your unconscious. How do you get it on side? If change has got to happen at the unconscious level as well as the conscious, how on earth do you do that? So I thought, for me, a storyteller, thought I'd tell myself a story. I'd invent a character and I would talk to it. And I very quickly realised that it wouldn't be able to talk back, because your unconscious doesn't articulate, doesn't put anything into words. So I was going to work out what its reactions were. And in a heartbeat, before I could stop to think, Bridget turned up. She was a hippie. She lived, in my imagination, she lived in a cave just underneath the top of a tor on Dartmoor. So up on a craggy peak somewhere, rather witch-like, I suppose. She wasn't ancient. She wasn't an ancient being. She was contemporary. She had blue eyes. I've got brown eyes. She's quite small, not tall, a bit wispy, a bit far away, always busy, always doing stuff. Whenever I went to visit her, she was always building a fire or damming up a stream or packing her cave with wood or something. She's always doing something. And I would find out what she thought by what I told her. So I would, when I first went, she wouldn't even come out and speak to me. The very first visit, I was total silence. I went up there and just started rabbiting to this imaginary friend, and no answer. So I trudged off back down the hill, thinking, huh, right, well, I'll come again. And I did. And so what I did, every few days, I would check in with this imaginary friend. I would go and see her, and I would check in with what had happened recently and where I was up to. And I would ask her stuff and tell her stuff and try and get advice for her. She never gave me advice, of course, because she never spoke. But actually, in her silence, I learned a lot, which I learned to think was me consulting my own inner thoughts. I think I came in the end to realize that food masks a lot of that. Food is an instant gratification, and it stops you feeling stuff, and it stops you really thinking things through, because it's just an instant way of, it's like putting a dummy in your mouth. The other thing about her that I loved was that she always made me laugh. And I learned to find her a source of wisdom. And actually, you know what? She was a protection. When people reacted to my weight loss and they would say stuff that I didn't agree with, particularly like, God, you've got that willpower. And I think, no, willpower's not it. I've had willpower before and that didn't do it. It's not really that. I just smile. And then I talked to Bridget about it, and she was always funny about it. She was always a bit sardonic in her silent way.
Mm.
So she was incredibly helpful. In the end, I learned to think Bridget was the single invention that really carried me through. It's the strangest thing. It's slightly out of body, really, because where did she come from?
She allowed you, by having something that you imagined out of your body, you allowed to get out of your own way. And she evolved as you evolved.
I guess she did, yeah. Yeah. She did. Our relationship changed, didn't it?
How is Bridget these days?
She's great. I mean, I recently consulted her about something. I don't very often do it these days. I don't do it about weight so much, but I did it about another decision I was making. And it was very funny because she just kind of looked at me and shrugged and just said, yeah, we can do that. And it was a big decision I was making. And she just thought, yeah,